come to save him. She didn't come again, although he strained his ears for another hour. No further words were spoken. But he knew he had heard it. She had come. He settled back into the needle discomfort of the mattress, tiredness finally overtaking him. The sobs had ceased, and even Barkus's snores seemed softer. He drifted into a dreamless, untroubled sleep. Chapter 2. It was a year into his time in the Order when Valin first killed a man. A year of hard lessons, imparted by hard masters, a year of punishing, unending routine. They woke at the fifth hour and began with the sword. Hours of swinging their wooden blades at the posts on the practice ground, trying to fend off Master Solis's attacks and copying the increasingly complicated sword scales he taught them. Valin continued to be most adept at parrying Solis's blows, but the master frequently found a way past his guard to send him bruised and frustrated to the dirt. The lesson of not allowing oneself to be fixed by his eyes had been well learnt, but Solis knew many other tricks. Feldrian was given over entirely to sword work, but Ildrian was the day of the bow, when Master Chekrin, a muscular, softly spoken Ilzalian, had them loosing arrows at the butts with their boy-sized strongbows. "Rhythm, boys. It's all in the rhythm," he told them. "Notch, draw, loose. Notch, draw, loose." Valin found the bow a hard skill to master. The weapon was tough to draw and difficult to aim, leaving his fingertips raw from the bowstring and his arms aching with growing muscle. His arrows often sank into the edge of the target or missed altogether. He came to dread the day he would face the test of the bow. 4 arrows sunk into the bullseye at 20 paces in the time it took a dropped scarf to fall to the ground. It seemed an impossible feat. Dentos quickly proved himself to be the best archer, his shafts rarely failing to find the bullseye. "Done this before, eh, boy?" Master Chekrin asked him. "Aye, master. My uncle Drelt taught me. He used to poach the Fife Lord's deer till they cut his fingers off." To Velin's annoyance, Norta was second best, his arrows finding the bull with grating regularity. The tension between them had grown since the first meal, unleavened by the blonde boy's arrogance. He sneered at the failings of the other boys, usually behind their backs, and spoke constantly of his family, though none of the others did. Norta spoke of his family's lands, their many houses, the days he spent hunting and riding with his father, who he claimed was first minister to the king. It was his father who had taught him the bow, a longbow of yew like the Cumbrellians used, not the composite horn and ash of their strongbows. Norta thought the longbow a superior weapon, all things considered. His father swore by it. Norta's father seemed to be a man of many opinions. Oprian was the day of the staff, taught them by Master Haunlin, the burnt man Valin had first seen in the dining hall. They sparred with wooden staffs about 4 feet in length. Later they would be replaced with the 5-foot poleaxe used by the Order when they fought en masse. Haunlin was a cheerful man, with a quick smile and a liking for song. He would often sing or chant as they practiced, soldier songs mostly, and a few love ballads, sung with a strange precision and clarity that reminded Valin of the minstrel he had once seen in the king's palace. He took to the staff quickly, liking the way it whistled when he swung it, the feel of it in his hands. At times he even preferred it to the sword. It was easier to handle and more solid somehow. His appreciation for the staff deepened when it became clear Norta had no ability with it at all. His staff was often snapped out of his hands by an opponent's blow, and he was ever sucking numbed fingers. Kigrian was a day they quickly came to dread, as it meant service in the stables. Hours spent shoveling dung, dodging iron-shod hooves and sharp teeth, then cleaning the myriad pieces of tack that hung on the walls. Master Rensiel was ruler of the stable, and his liking for the cane made Master Solis seem positively restrained.
"I said clean it, don't tickle it, lackwit," he spat at Canis,
his cane leaving red wheels on the boy's neck as he tried to work polish into a stirrup. Whatever his harshness to the boys, Rensiel was all tenderness to his horses, speaking to them in soft whispers and lovingly brushing their hides. Valen's dislike of the man was tempered by the blankness he saw in his eyes. Master Renseal preferred horses to people. His hands twitched constantly, and he often stopped in mid-tirade, wandering off mumbling under his breath. The eye said it all. Master Renseal was mad. Retrin was a favorite with most of the boys, the day when Master Huttrell would teach them the ways of the wild. They were led on long treks through the woods and hills, learning which plants were safe to eat, and which could be used as a poison to be smeared on arrowheads. They were taught to light fires without flint, and trap rabbits and hares. They would lie for hours in the undergrowth, trying to remain hidden as Huttrell hunted them down, usually within a few minutes. Valen was often second last to be found, with Canis remaining hidden longest. Of all the boys, even those who had grown up amongst woodland and fields, he proved the most adept in the outdoors, particularly in trekking. Sometimes they would stay in the forest overnight, and it was always Canis who brought in the first meal. Master Huttrell was one of the few masters who never used the cane, but his punishments could be severe, once making Norta and Valen run bare-assed through a copse of nettles for bickering over how best to place a snare. He spoke with a quiet confidence, and rarely used more words than he had to, seeming to prefer the sign language some of the masters used. It was similar to that used by tongueless Master Smentil when he communicated with Solis, but less complex, designed for use when enemies or prey were near. Valen learned quickly, as did Barkus, but Canis seemed to absorb it instantly, his slender fingers forming the intricate shapes with uncanny accuracy. Despite his aptitude, Master Huttrell seemed oddly distant from Canis, his praise restrained, if expressed at all. Sometimes, during one of the overnight treks, Valen would catch Huttrell staring at Canis from across the camp, his expression unreadable in the firelight. Heldrian was the hardest of days. Hours of running around the practice ground with a heavy stone in each hand, freezing swims across the river, and hard lessons in unarmed combat under Master Intris, a compact but lightning-fast man with a broken nose and several missing teeth. He taught them the secrets of the kick and the punch, how to twist the fist at the last instant, how to raise the knee first, then to extend the leg into a kick, how to block a blow, trip an opponent, or throw one over your shoulder. Few boys enjoyed Heldrian. It left them too bruised and exhausted to appreciate the evening meal. Only Barkus liked it, his large frame best suited to soaking up the punishment. He seemed impervious to pain, and none relished being partnered with him for the sparring. Eltrian was supposedly a day of rest and observance, but for the youngest boys it meant a round of tedious drudgery in the laundry or the kitchen. If they were lucky, they would be chosen to help Master Smentil in the garden, which at least provided the chance at a stolen apple or two. In the evening there would be extra observance and catechism, this being the faith's day, and a solid hour of silent contemplation, where they would sit, heads bowed, each lost in his own thoughts or succumbing to the overpowering need for sleep, which could be dangerous, as any boy caught sleeping would earn the harshest beating and a night walking the walls with no cloak. Valen's favorite part of each day was the hour before lights out. All the discipline would evaporate in a round of raucous banter and horseplay. Dentos would tell another story about his uncles. Barkus would make them laugh with a joke or an uncanny imitation of one of the masters. Canis, normally given to silence, would tell one of the thousand or more old stories he knew whilst they practiced their sign language or sword strokes. He found himself spending more time with Canis than the others, the slight boy's reticence and intelligence a faint echo of his mother. For his part, Canis seemed surprised but gratified by the companionship. Valen suspected his life before the Order had been somewhat lonely, as Canis was clearly so unused to being with other boys. Although neither of them talked of their lives before, unlike Norta, who had never been able to shake the habit, despite angry responses from the others and the occasional beating from the masters. "You have no family but the Order." Valen knew the truth of the Aspect's words now. They were becoming family. They had no one but each other. Their first test came in the month of Suntarin, nearly a year since Valen had been left at the gate. The test of the run. They had been told little about what it entailed, except that each year this test saw more expulsions than any other. They were trooped out into the courtyard, along with the other boys of similar age, about 200 in all. They had been told to bring their bows, one quiver of arrows, hunting knife, water flask, and nothing else. The aspect led them in a brief recitation of the Catechism of Faith before informing them of what to expect.
"The test of the run is where we discover who among you is truly fit to serve the order. You have had the privilege of a year in service to the faith. But in the sixth order, privileges must be earned. You will be taken upriver by boat and left at different places on the bank. You must be back here by midnight tomorrow. Any who do not arrive in time will be allowed to keep their weapons and will be given 3 gold crowns.
He nodded to the masters and left. Valin felt the fear and uncertainty about him, but did not share it. He would pass the test. He had to. There was nowhere for him to go.
"To the riverbank at the run," Solis barked. "No slacking. Pick your feet up, Sendal. This isn't a shitting dance floor."
Waiting at the riverside wharf were 3 barges, large, shallow-draft boats, with black-painted hulls and red canvas sails. They were a common sight on the Corvine River estuary, running coal along the coast from the mines in the south to feed the myriad chimneys of Varenshold. Bargemen were a distinct group, wearing black scarves around their necks and a band of silver in their left ear, notorious drinkers and brawlers when not plying their trade. Many an Israelin mother would warn a wayward daughter, "Be a good girl, or you'll wed no better than a bargeman." Solis exchanged a few words with the master of their barge, a wiry man who glared suspiciously at the silent assembly of boys, handing him a purse of coin and barking at them to get aboard and muster in the center of the deck.
"And don't touch anything, lackbrains!"
"I've never been to sea before," Dentos commented as they sat down on the hard planks of the deck. "This isn't the sea," Norta informed him. "It's the river. My uncle Gymnos went to sea," Dentos continued, ignoring Norta, as most of them did. "Never came back. Me mum said he got eaten by a whale."
"What's a whale?"
asked Mikkel, a plump Renfalen boy who had contrived to retain his excess weight despite months of hard exercise. "It's a big animal that lives in the sea," Canis replied. He tended to know the answer to most questions. He gave Dentos a nudge. "And it doesn't eat people. Your uncle was probably eaten by a shark. Some of them grow as big as a whale."
"How would you know?"
Norta sneered, as he usually did whenever Canis offered an opinion.
"Ever seen one?"
"Yes." Norta flushed and fell silent, scratching at a loose splinter on the deck with his hunting knife. "When, Canis?" Valin prompted his friend. "When did you see the shark?" Canis smiled a little, something he did rarely. "A year or so ago, in the Erinian, I was taken to sea once. There are many creatures that live in the sea. Seals and orcas and more fish than you can count. And sharks. One of them came up to our ship. It was over 30 feet from tip to tail. One of the sailors said they feed on orcas and whales. People too, if you're unlucky enough to be in the water when they're around. There are stories of them ramming ships to sink them and feed on the crew." Norta snorted in derision, but the others were clearly fascinated.
"Did you see pirates?"
Dentos asked eagerly. "They say the Iranian is thick with them." Canis shook his head. "No pirates. They don't bother realm ships since the war."
"Which war?"
Barkus said. "The Maldanian. The one Master Graylin talks about all the time. The king sent a fleet to burn the Maldanian's biggest city. All the pirates in the Iranian are Maldanians, so they learned to leave us alone."
"Would it make more sense to burn their fleet?" Barkus wondered. "That way there wouldn't be any pirates at all."
"They can always build more ships," Valin said. "Burning a city leaves a memory, passed from parent to child. Make sure they won't forget us."
"Could have just killed them all," Norta suggested sullenly. "No pirates, no piracy."
Master Solis's cane swept down from nowhere, catching him on the hand and making him release his knife, still embedded in the deck.
"I said don't touch anything, Sendal."
His gaze swiveled to Canis.
"Voyager, are you, Nissa?"
Canis bowed his head. "Only once, Master.
Really? Where did you go on this adventure?
To the Wenzel Isle. My, one of the passengers had business there.
Solis grunted, bent down to prise Norta's knife from the deck and tossed it to him. Sheath it, fop. You'll need a sharp blade before long.
Were you there, master? Velen asked him. He was the only one who dared ask Solis anything, braving the risk of a caning. Solis could be fierce, or he could be informative. It was impossible to tell which, until you asked the question. Were you there when the Meldanian city burned?
Solis's gaze flicked to him, pale eyes meeting his.
There was a question in them, an inquisitiveness. For the first time, Velen realized Solis thought he knew more than he did. Thought his father had told him stories of his many battles.
That there was an insult concealed in his questions. No, Solis replied. I was on the northern border then. I'm sure Master Grayling will answer any questions you have about that war.
He moved away, to thrash another boy whose hand had strayed too close to a coil of rope. The barges sailed north, following the long arc of the river and dashing any thought Velen had of simply following the river bank back to the order house. It was too long a journey. If he wanted to be back in time, it meant a trek through the forest. He eyed the dark mass of trees warily. Although the lessons with Master Huttrell had made them familiar with the forest, the thought of a blind journey through the woods was not pleasant. He knew how easily a boy could be lost in amongst the trees, wandering in circles for hours.
Head south, Canis whispering next to his ear. Away from the North Star. Head south until you meet the riverbank, then follow it until you come to the wharf. Then you have to swim the river.
Velen glanced at him, and saw that Canis was gazing blithely up at the sky, as if he hadn't spoken. Looking around at the bored faces of his companions, it was clear to Velen they hadn't heard the advice. Canis was helping him, but not the others. They began to drop the boys off after about 3 hours sailing. There was little ceremony to it. Solis simply chose a boy at random, and told him to jump over the side and swim for shore. Dentos was the first from their group to go.
See you back at the house, Dentos, Velen encouraged him.
Dentos, silent for once, smiled back weakly before hitching his strongbow over his shoulder and vaulting over the rail into the river. He swam to the bank quickly and paused to shake off the river water, then disappeared into the trees with a brief wave. Barkus was next, theatrically balancing atop the rail before performing a backflip into the river. A few boys clapped appreciatively. Mikkel went next, but not without some trepidation.
I'm not sure I can swim that far, master, he stammered,
staring down at the dark waters of the river.
Then try to drown quietly, Solis said, tipping him over the rail.
Mikkel made a loud splash and seemed to remain underwater for an age. It was with some relief they saw him surface, a short distance away, sputtering and flailing before he regained his composure and began to swim towards the bank. Canis was next, accepting Velen's wish of good luck with a nod before jumping wordlessly over the rail. Norta followed him shortly after, controlling his evident fear with some effort. He said to Solis,
Master, if I don't return, I would like my father to know—
You don't have a father, Sendal. Get in there.
Norta bit back an angry retort and hauled himself onto the rail, diving in after a second's hesitation.
Sorna, your turn.
Velen wondered if it was significant that he was the last to go, and would therefore have the longest distance to travel. He went to the rail, his bowstring tight against his chest, pulling the strap on his quiver taut so it wouldn't come adrift in the water. He put both hands on the rail and prepared to vault over.
The others are not to be helped, Sorna, Solis told him.
He had said nothing like this to the other boys.
Get yourself back. Let them worry about themselves.
Velen frowned.
Master? You heard me. Whatever happens, it's their fate, not yours.
He jerked his head at the river.
On your way.
It was clear he would say nothing more, so Velen took a firm grip of the rail and swung himself over, falling feet first into the water, enveloped instantly in the shocking coldness of it. He fought a moment's panic as his head went under, then kicked for the surface.
Breaking into the air, he dragged it into his lungs and struck out for the shore, which suddenly seemed a lot further away. By the time he struggled to his feet on the shingle bank, the barges had passed him by and were well upstream. He thought he saw Master Solace still at the rail, staring after him, but couldn't be sure. He unhitched his bow and ran the string through his forefinger and thumb to wring the water out. Master Chekrin said a damp bowstring was as much use as a legless dog. He checked his arrows, making sure the water hadn't penetrated the waxed leather seal on the quiver, and made sure his knife was still at his side. He shook water from his hair as he scanned the trees, seeing only a mass of shadow and foliage. He knew he was facing south, but would soon wander off course when night came. If he was to follow Canis's advice, he would have to climb a tree or two to find the North Star, not something easily attempted in the dark. Although grateful that the test took place in summer, he was starting to chill from the swim. Master Huttrell had taught them that the best way to dry off without benefit of a fire was to run. The heat of the body would turn the water to steam. He set off at a steady run, trying not to sprint, knowing he would need his energy in the hours to come. He was soon embraced by the cool dark of the forest, and found himself instinctively scanning the shadows, a habit he had acquired during the many hours of hunting and hiding. Master Huttrell's words came back to him. A smart enemy seeks the shadow and stays quiet. Balin suppressed a shiver and ran on. He ran for a solid hour, keeping a steady pace and ignoring the growing ache in his legs. The river water was quickly replaced by sweat, and his chill receded. He checked his direction with occasional glances at the sun and tried to fight the sensation of time passing quicker than it should. The thought of being pushed out of the gates with a handful of coins and nowhere to go was both terrifying and incomprehensible. He had a brief and equally nightmarish vision of turning up on his father's doorstep, pathetically clutching his coins and begging to be let in. He forced the image away and kept running. He took a break after covering about 5 miles, perching on a log to drink from his flask and catch a breath. He wondered how his companions were faring. Were they running like him or stumbling lost among the trees? The others are not to be helped. Was it a warning or a threat? Certainly there were dangers in the forest, but nothing to pose a serious threat to the boys of the Order, toughened by months of training. He pondered for a short while, finding no answers, before stopping his flask and rising, still scanning the shadows. He froze. The wolf sat on its haunches 10 short yards away, bright green eyes regarding him with silent curiosity. Its pelt was grey and silver, and it was very large. Valen had never been this close to a wolf before, his only glimpses vague, loping shadows seen through the mists of the morning, a rare sight so close to the city. He was struck by the size of the animal, the power evident in the muscle beneath its fur. The wolf tilted its head as Valen returned his gaze. He felt no fear. Master Huttrell had told them that stories of wolves stealing babies and savaging shepherd boys were myths. "Wolf'll leave you be if you leave him be," he said. But still, the wolf was big, and its eyes... The wolf sat, silent, still, a faint breeze ruffling the silver-grey mass of its fur, and Valen felt something new stir in the boy's heart. "You're beautiful," he told the wolf in a whisper. It was gone in an instant, turning and leaping into the foliage quicker than he could follow. It barely made a sound. He felt a rare smile on his lips, and stored the memory of the wolf firmly in his head, knowing he would never forget it. The forest was called the Erlish, a 20-mile-thick, 70-mile-long band of trees stretching from the northern walls of Varenshold to the foothills of the Renfeilin border. Some said the king had a love for the forest, that it had captured his soul somehow. It was forbidden to take a tree from the Erlish without a king's command, and only those families who had lived within its confines for 3 generations were allowed to remain. From his meagre knowledge of the realm's history, Valen knew war had come here once, a great battle between the Renfeilins and Azraelins, raging amongst the trees for a day and a night. The Asraelins won, and the Lord of Renfell had to bow the knee to King Janus, which is why his heirs were now called fieflords, and had to give money and soldiers to the king whenever he wanted them. It was a story his mother told him when she had succumbed to his pestering for more information on his father's exploits. It was here that he had won the king's regard, and been raised to sword of the realm. His mother was vague on the details, saying simply that his father was a great warrior and had been very brave. He found himself sweeping his gaze across the forest floor as he ran, eyes searching for the glitter of metal, hoping to find some token from the battle, an arrowhead or perhaps a dagger or even a sword. He wondered if Solas would let him keep any souvenirs and, thinking it unlikely, began to ponder the best hiding places on offer in the house.
Snap!
He ducked, rolled, came up on his feet, crouching behind the trunk of an oak, the whisper of an arrow's flight hissing through the ferns. The sound of a bowstring was an unmistakable warning for a boy like him. He calmed his pounding heart with effort and strained to listen for further signals. Was it a hunter? Perhaps he had been mistaken for a deer. He discounted the thought instantly. He was no deer, and any hunter could tell the difference. Someone had tried to kill him. He realized he had unhitched his bow and notched an arrow, all done instinctively. He rested his back against the trunk and waited, listening to the forest, letting it tell him who was coming for him. "Nature has a voice," Huttrell's words. "Learn to hear it, and you'll never be lost, and no man will ever take you unawares." He opened his ears to the voice of the forest, the sigh of the wind, the rustle of the leaves, and the creak of the branches. No birdsong. It meant a predator was close. It could be one man, could be more. He waited for the telltale crack of a branch underfoot, or the scrape of boot leather on soil, but nothing came. If his enemy was on the move, he knew how to mask the sound. But he had other senses, and the forest could tell him many things. He closed his eyes and inhaled softly through his nose. "Don't suck the air in like a pig at a trough," Huttrell had cautioned him once. "Give your nose time to sort the scent. Be patient." He let his nose do the work, tasting the mingled perfume of bluebells in bloom, rotting vegetation, animal droppings, and sweat. Man's sweat. The wind was coming from his left, carrying the scent. It was impossible to tell whether the bowman was waiting or moving. It was the faintest sound, little more than a rustle of cloth, but to Valen it was a shout. He darted from behind the oak in a crouch, drawing and loosing the shaft in a single motion, before scooting back into cover, rewarded with a short grunt of pained surprise. He lingered for the briefest second. Stay or flee. The compulsion to run was strong, the dark embrace of the forest suddenly a welcome refuge. But he knew he couldn't. "The Order doesn't run," Solas had said. He peered out from behind his oak, taking a second before he saw it, the gull-fletched shaft of his arrow sticking upright from the carpet of ferns about 15 yards away. He notched another arrow and approached in a low crouch, eyes scanning constantly for other enemies, ears alive with the voice of the forest, nose twitching. The man was dressed in dirty green trews and tunic. He had an ash bow clutched in his hand, with a crow-feathered shaft notched in the string, a sword strapped across his back, a knife in his boot, and Valen's arrow in his throat. He was quite dead. Stepping closer, Valen saw the growing patch of blood spreading out from the neck wound. A lot of blood. Caught the big vein, Valen realized. But I thought I was a poor archer. He laughed, high and shrill, then convulsed and vomited, collapsing to all fours and retching uncontrollably. It was a few moments before the shock and nausea receded enough for him to think clearly. This man, this dead man, had tried to kill him. Why? He had never seen him before. Was he an outlaw? Some homeless footpad thinking he had found an easy victim in a lone boy? He forced himself to look at the dead man again, noting the quality of his boots and the stitching on his clothes. He hesitated, then lifted the dead man's right hand, lying slack on the bowstring. It was a bowman's hand, rough palms with calluses on the tips of the first two fingers. This man had made his living with the bow. Valin doubted any outlaw would be so practiced, or so well-dressed. A sudden, sickening thought popped into his head. Is it part of the test? For a moment, he was almost convinced. What better way to weed out the chaff, seed the forest with assassins, and see who survived? Think of all the gold coins they'd save. But somehow he couldn't bring himself to believe it. The order was brutal, but not murderous. Then why? He shook his head. It was a mystery he wouldn't solve by staying here. Where there was one, there could be more. He would get back to the order house and ask Master Solis for guidance, if he lived that long. He got shakily to his feet, spitting the last dregs of gorge from his mouth, taking a final look at the dead man, and debating whether to take his sword or his knife, but deciding it would be a mistake. For some reason, he suspected it might be necessary to deny knowledge of the killing, which led him to briefly consider retrieving the arrow from the man's neck, but he couldn't face the prospect of drawing the shaft from the flesh. Instead, he contented himself with snipping off the fletching with his hunting knife. The gull feathers were a clear signal that the man had been killed by a member of the Order. He fought a fresh bout of nausea at the grinding sensation of the arrow as he grasped it, and the wet, sucking sound it made as he sawed at the shaft. It was done quickly, but seemed to take an age. He pocketed the fletching and backed away from the corpse, scraping his boots on the soil to erase any tracks, before turning and resuming his run. His legs felt leaden, and he stumbled several times before his body remembered the smooth, loping stride learned through months of training on the practice ground. The slack, lifeless features of the dead man flashed through his mind continually, but he shook the image away, suppressing it ruthlessly. He tried to kill me. I won't grieve for a man who would seek to murder a boy. But he found he couldn't deafen himself to the words his mother had once shouted at his father. Your stench of blood sickens me. Night seemed to fall in an instant, probably because he dreaded it. He found himself seeing bowmen lurking in every shadow. More than once he leapt for shelter from assassins which turned out to be bushes or tree stumps when he looked closer. He had rested only once since killing the assassin, a brief feverish sip of water behind the broad trunk of a beech, his eyes darting about constantly for enemies. It felt safer to run. A moving target was harder to hit. But this vague sense of security evaporated when the darkness came. It was like running in a void where every step brought the threat of a painful fall. He had tripped twice, sprawling in a tangle of weapons and fear, before accepting that he would have to walk from now on. The bearings he took from the North Star by finding the odd clearing or hauling himself up a tree trunk told him he was holding a steady course southward. But how far he had come or the distance he still had to cover, he couldn't tell. He peered ahead with increasing desperation, all the time hoping to glimpse the silver sheen of the river through the trees. It was when he had stopped to get another bearing that he saw the fire, a single flickering blob of orange in the black-blue mass of the forest. Keep running! He almost followed the instinctive command, turning away and taking another stride towards the south, but stopped. None of the boys from the Order would light a fire during the test. They just didn't have time. It could be a coincidence. Just some of the king's foresters camped out for the night. But something made him doubt it, a murmur of wrongness in the back of his mind. It was a strange sensation, almost musical. He turned around, unslinging his bow and notching an arrow before beginning a cautious advance. He knew he was taking a risk, both in investigating the fire and indulging in a delay when his deadline for getting back to the house could not be far away. But he had to know. The blob grew into a fire slowly, flickering red and gold in the infinite blackness. He stopped, opening himself to the song of the forest again, hunting through the nocturnal resonance until he caught them. Voices. Male, adult, two men, quarreling. He crept closer, using the hunter's walk taught by Master Huttrell, lifting his foot a hair's breadth from the ground and sliding it forward and to the side before laying it down softly, after tentatively checking the soil for any branches or twigs that could give him away in an instant. The voices became clearer as he closed on the camp, confirming his suspicions. Two men engaged in a bitter argument.
"Hasn't stopped bleeding,"
a self-pitying whine, its owner as yet invisible.
"Look, it's gushing like a slit hog." "Stop fiddling with it then, shitbrain,"
an exasperated hiss. Valen could see this one, a stocky man seated to the right of the fire, the sight of the sword on his back and the bow propped close to his hand, provoking an icy shiver. No coincidence. He had a sack open on the floor between his booted feet, studying its contents intently, in between casting tired insults at his companion.
"Little bastard,"
the unseen whiner continued, deaf to the admonishments of his stocky companion.
"Plain dead, vicious, sneaky little bastard. You were warned they were tough," the stocky man said. "Should have put another iron head in him to make sure before you got so close. Got him square in the neck, didn't I? Should have been enough. I've seen grown men go down like a sack of spuds from a wound like that. Not that little shit, though. Wish we kept him breathing a little longer. You disgusting animal."
There was little venom in the stocky man's words. He was increasingly preoccupied with the contents of the sack, a frown creasing his broad forehead.
"You know, I'm still not sure it's him."
Valen, fighting to keep his heart steady, shifted his gaze to the sack, noting the roundness of its contents and the dark, wet stain on the lower half. A sudden, overpowering chill of realization gripped him, fearing he would faint as the forest swayed around him, and he fought down a gasp of horror, the sound undoubtedly an invite for a quick death.
"Let me see,"
the whiner said, moving into view for the first time. He was short, wiry, with pointed features and a wispy beard on his bony chin. His left arm was cradled in his right, a bloodied bandage leaking continually through his spidery fingers.
"Gotta be him. Has to be."
He sounded desperate.
"You heard what the other one said?"
"Other one?" Valen strained to hear more, still sickened, but his heart steadied by a growing anger.
"He gave me the shivers, he did," the stocky man responded with a shudder. "Wouldn't have trusted him if he told me the sky was blue."
He squinted at the sack again, then reached inside, extracting the contents, holding it up by the hair, dripping, turning it to examine the slack, distorted features. Valen would have vomited again if there was anything left in his stomach.
"Mikkel. They killed Mikkel." "Could be him," the stocky man mused. "Death'll change your face for sure. Just don't see much of a family resemblance. Brack would know. He said he'd seen the boy before."
The whiner moved out of the firelight again.
"Where is he anyway? Should have been here by now."
"Yeah," the stocky man agreed, returning his trophy to the sack.
"Don't think he's gonna."
Whiner was silent for a moment before muttering,
"Little lord of shits."
Brack. So he had a name. Valen wondered briefly if anyone would wear a mourning locket for Brack. If his widow, or mother, or brother would offer thanks for his life, and the goodness and wisdom he had left behind. But as Brack was an assassin, a killer waiting in the woods to murder children, he doubted it. No one would weep for Brack, as no one would weep for these two. His fist tightened on the bow, bringing it up to draw a bead on the stocky man's throat. He would kill this one and wound the other. An arrow in the leg or the stomach would do it. Then he would make him talk. Then he would kill him, too. For Mikkel. Something growled in the forest. Something hidden, something deadly. Valen whirled, drawing the bow, too late, knocked flat by a hard mass of muscle, his bow gone from his hand. He scrabbled for his knife, instinctively kicking out as he did so, hitting nothing. There were screams as he surged to his feet, screams of pain and terror. Something wet lashed across his face, stinging his eyes. He staggered, tasting the iron sting of blood, wiping frantically at his eyes, blearily focusing on the now silent camp, seeing two yellow eyes gleaming in the firelight above a red-stained muzzle. The eyes met his, blinked once, and the wolf was gone. Random thoughts tumbled through his mind. It tracked me. You're beautiful. Followed me here to kill these men? Beautiful wolf? They killed Mikkel, no family resemblance. Stop that! He forced discipline on the torrent of thought, dragging air into his lungs, calming down enough to move closer to the camp. The stocky man lay on his back, hands reaching towards a throat that was no longer there, his face frozen in fear. The whiner had managed to run a few strides before being cut down. His head was twisted at a sharp angle to his shoulders. From the stench staining the air around him, it was clear his fear had mastered him at the end. There was no sign of the wolf, just the whisper of undergrowth moving in the wind. Reluctantly, he turned to the sack still lying at the stocky man's feet. What do I do for Mikkel? Mikkel's dead, Valin told Master Solis, water dripping from his face. It had started to rain a few miles back and he was drenched as he labored up the hill towards the gate. Exhaustion and the shock of the events in the forest combining to leave him numb and incapable of more than the most basic words. Assassins in the forest. Solis reached out to steady him as he swayed, his legs suddenly feeling too weak to keep him upright. How many? Three. That I saw. Dead, too. He handed Solis the fletching he had cut from his arrow. Solis asked Master Huttrell to watch the gate and led Valin inside. Instead of taking him to the boys' room in the north tower, he led him to his own quarters, a small room in the south wall bastion. He built up the fire and told Valin to strip off his wet clothes, giving him a blanket to warm himself, while fire began to lick at the logs in the hearth. Now, he said, handing Valin a mug of warmed milk. Tell me what happened. Everything you can remember. Leave nothing out. So he told him of the wolf, and the man he had killed, and the whiner and the stocky man, and Mikkel. Where is it? Master? Mikkel's. Remains. I buried it. Valin suppressed a violent shudder and drank more milk, the warmth burning his insides. Scraped the soil up with my knife. Couldn't think of anything else to do with it. Master Solis nodded and stared at the fletching in his hand, his pale eyes unreadable. Valin glanced around the room, finding it less bare than he expected. Several weapons were set on the wall. A poleaxe, a long iron-bladed spear, some kind of stone-headed club, plus several daggers and knives of different patterns. Several books stood on the shelves, the lack of dust indicating Master Solis hadn't placed them there for decoration. On the far wall there was some kind of tapestry, fashioned from a goatskin stretched on a wooden frame, the hide adorned with a bizarre mix of stick figures and unfamiliar symbols. Lornak war banner, Solis said. Valin looked away, feeling like a spy. To his surprise, Solis went on. Lornak boy children become part of a war band from an early age. Each band has his own banner, and every member swears a blood oath to die defending it. Valin rubbed a bead of water from his nose. What do the symbols mean, Master?
They list the band's battles, the heads they have taken, the honors granted them by their high priestess. The Lornak have a passion for history. Children are punished if they cannot recite the saga of their clan. It's said they have one of the largest libraries in the world, although no outsider has ever seen it. They love their stories, and will sit for hours around the campfire listening to the shamans. They especially like the heroic tales, stories that have outnumbered war bands winning victory against the odds, brave lone warriors questing for lost talismans in the bowels of the earth, boys killing assassins in the forest with the aid of a wolf. Valin looked at him sharply. It's no story, Master.
Solis tossed another log on the fire, scattering sparks over the hearth. He prodded the logs with a poker, not looking at Valin as he spoke.
The Lornak have no word for a secret. Did you know that? To them, everything is important,
to be written down, recorded, told over and over. The Order has no such belief. We have fought battles that left more than 100 corpses on the ground, and not a word of it has ever been set down. The Order fights, but often it fights in shadow, without glory or reward. We have no banners. He tossed Valen's fletching into the fire. The damp feathers hissed in the flame, then curled and withered to nothing. Mikkel was taken by a bear, a rare sight in the Earlish, but some still prowl the depths of the woods. You found the remains and reported it to me. Tomorrow Master Huttrell will retrieve them, and we will give our fallen brother to the fire, and thank him for the gift of his life. Valen felt no shock, no surprise. It was obvious there was more here than he could know. Why did you warn me not to help the others, Master? Solis stared into the fire for a while, and Valen had decided he wasn't going to answer when he said, We sever our ties with our blood when we give ourselves to the Order. We understand this, outsiders do not. Sometimes the Order is no protection against the feuds that rage beyond our walls. We cannot always protect you. The others were not likely to be hunted. His fist was white on the poker as he prodded the fire. His cheek muscles bulged with suppressed rage. I was wrong. Mikkel paid the price of my mistake. My father, Valen thought. They sought my death to wound him. Whoever they are, they know him not. Master, what of the wolf? Why would a wolf seek to aid me? Master Solis put the poker aside and rubbed his chin thoughtfully. That's a thing I don't understand. I've been many places and seen many things, but a wolf killing men is not one of them. And killing without feeding. He shook his head. Wolves don't do that. There's something else at work here. Something that touches the dark. Valen's shivers intensified momentarily. The dark. The servants in his father's house had used the phrase sometimes, usually in hushed tones when they thought no one else could hear. It was something people said when things happened that shouldn't happen. Children being born with the blood sign discoloring their faces. Dogs giving birth to cats, and ships found adrift at sea with no crew. Dark. Two of your brothers made it back before you did, Solis said. You better go and tell them about Mikkel. This interview was clearly over. Solis would tell him nothing else. It was obvious and sad. Master Solis was a man of many stories and much wisdom. He knew much more than the correct grip on a sword or the right angle to slash a blade at a man's eyes. But Valen suspected little of it was ever heard. He wanted to hear more of the Lonak and their war bands and their high priestess. He wanted to know of the dark. But Solis's eyes were fixed on the fire, lost in thought, the way his father had looked so many times. So he got to his feet and said, Yes, Master. He drained the rest of his warm milk and gathered the blanket around him, clutching his damp clothes as he moved to the door. Tell no one, Zorna. There was a note of command in Solis's voice, the tone he used before he swung his cane. Confide in no one. This is a secret that could mean your death. Yes, Master, Valen repeated. He went out into the chilled hallway and made his way to the North Tower, huddled and shivering, the cold so intense he wondered if he would collapse before he made it up the steps. But the milk Master Solis had given him left just enough warmth and sustenance to fuel his journey. He found Dentos and Barkas in the room when he staggered through the door, both slumped on their bunks, fatigue evident in their faces. Strangely, they seemed enlivened by his arrival, both rising to greet him with backslaps and forced jokes. Can't find your way in the dark, eh? Barkas laughed. Would have beaten this one back easily if I hadn't been caught by the current. Current? Valen asked, bemused by the warmth of their welcome. Crossed too early, Barkas explained. Up near the Narrows. Thought I was done, I can tell you. Got washed up right opposite the gate, but Dentos was already there. Valen dumped his clothes on the bunk and moved to the fire, bathing in the warmth.
You were first, Dentos?
Aye. We're sure it will be Caenis, but we've not seen him yet.
Valen was surprised, too. Canis's woodcraft left them all to shame. Still, he lacked Barkus's strength and Dentos's speed.
"But at least we beat the other companies,"
Barkus said, referring to the boys in other groups.
"None of them have turned up yet, lazy bastards."
"Yeah," Dentos agreed. "Passed a few of them on the way. Lost as a virgin in a brothel, they were."
Valen frowned. "What's a brothel?" The other two exchanged an amused glance, and Barkus changed the subject.
"We smuggled some apples from the kitchen."
He pulled back his bed covers to reveal his prizes.
"Pies, too. We'll have us a feast when the others get here."
He lifted an apple to his mouth for a hearty bite. They had all become enthusiastic thieves. It was a universal habit. Anything of the meanest value could be expected to disappear in short order, if not securely hidden. The straw in their mattresses had long since been replaced with any stray piece of fabric or soft hide they could lay their hands on. Punishment for theft was often severe, but bereft of any lectures on immorality or dishonesty, and soon they came to realize that they were not being punished for stealing, but for getting caught. Barkus was their most prolific thief, especially when it came to food, closely followed by Mikkel, who specialized in clothing. Mikkel. Valen stared into the fire, biting his lip, deciding how to phrase the lie. "It's a bad thing," he decided. "It's a hard thing to lie to your friends." "Mikkel's dead," he said finally. He couldn't think of a kinder way to say it, and winced at the sudden silence. "He was taken by a bear. I found what was left." Behind him he heard Barker spit out his mouthful of apple. There was a rustle as Dentos sank heavily onto his bunk. Valen gritted his teeth and went on.
"Master Hotchell will bring the body back tomorrow, so we can give him to the fire."
A log crackled in the fireplace. The chill was almost gone, and the heat was starting to make his skin itch. "So we can give thanks for his life." Nothing was said. He thought Dentos might be crying, but he didn't have the heart to turn and see for sure. After a while, he moved away from the fire and went to his bunk, laying his clothes out to dry, unstringing his bow and stowing his quiver. The door opened and Norta entered, rain-soaked but triumphant.
"Fourth!" he exulted. "I was sure I'd be last."
Valen hadn't seen him cheerful before. It was disconcerting, as was Norta's ignorance of their evident grief.
"I even got lost twice," he laughed, dumping his gear on his bunk. "Saw a wolf, too."
He went to the fire, hands splayed, to soak up the heat.
"So scared I couldn't move."
"You saw a wolf?" Valen asked.
"Oh, yes. Big bastard. Think he'd already fed, though. There was blood on his snout."
"What kind of bear?" Dentos asked.
"What?
Was it a black or a brown? Browns are bigger and nastier. Blacks don't come near men, mostly."
"It wasn't a bear,"
Norta said, puzzled.
"A wolf," I said.
"I don't know," Valen told Dentos. "I didn't see it." "Then how'd you know it was a bear?"
"Mikkel got taken by a bear," Barkus told Norta.
"Claw marks," Valen said, realizing deceit was more difficult than he'd imagined. "He was in bits."
"Bits?"
Norta claimed in disgust.
"Mikkel was in bits?
'Cause my uncle said you don't get browns in the Earlish," Dentos said dully. "Only get 'em in the north."
"I bet it was that wolf I saw,"
Norta whispered in shock.
"The wolf I saw ate Mikkel. It would have eaten me if it hadn't been full."
"Wolves don't eat people," Dentos said.
"Maybe it was rabid."
He sank onto his bunk in shock.
"I was nearly eaten by a rabid wolf."
And so it went. The other boys arrived one by one, tired and wet but relieved at having passed the test, their smiles fading when they heard the news. Dentos and Norta argued over wolves and bears, and Barkus shared out his meager spoils to be eaten in numb silence. Valen wrapped himself in his blanket and tried to forget the sight of Mikkel's slack, lifeless features, and the feel of dead flesh through the fabric of the sack as he scraped a shallow grave in the dirt. He woke, shuddering with cold, a few hours later. The last vestiges of a dream fled from his mind as his eyes grew accustomed to the dark. He was grateful the dream had slipped away, The few images lingering in his mind told him it was best forgotten. The other boys were asleep, Barker snoring softly for once, the logs in the fireplace blackened and smouldering. He stumbled out of bed to relight the fire. The darkness of the room suddenly scared him more than the gloom of the forest. "There are no more logs, brother." He turned to find Canis sitting on his bunk. He was still dressed, his clothes glistening with damp in the dim moonlight, seeping through the shutters. His face was hidden in shadow. "When did you get in?" Velen asked, rubbing feeling back into his hands. He never knew a body could get so cold. "A while ago." Kenneth's voice was a vacant drone, drained of emotion. "You heard about Mikkel?" Velen began to pace about, hoping to walk some warmth back into his muscles. "Yes," Kenneth replied. "Norta said it was a wolf. Dentos said a bear." Velen frowned, detecting a note of humor in his brother's voice. He shrugged it off. They all reacted differently. Jennis, Mikkel's closest friend, had actually laughed when they told him. A full, hearty laugh that went on and on. In fact, he laughed so much, Barkus had to slap him before he stopped. "A bear," Velen said. "Really?" Velen was sure Canis hadn't moved, but he fancied there was a quizzical incline to his head. "Dentos said you found him. That must have been bad." Mikkel's blood was thick, clotting in the sack, seeping through the weave to stain his hands. "I thought you'd be here when I got in." Velen wrapped his blanket more firmly around his shoulders. "I bet Barkus an afternoon in the garden you'd beat us all back." "Oh, I would have. But I was distracted. I happened across a mystery in the forest. Perhaps you could help me puzzle it out." "Tell me, what do you make of a dead man with an arrow in his throat? An arrow with no fletching?" Valen's shudders became almost uncontrollable, his flesh trembling so much his blanket slipped to the floor. "The woods are thick with outlaws, I hear," he stammered. "Indeed. So thick I found two more. Not killed with arrows, though. Mayhap they were taken by a bear, like Mikkel. Perhaps even the same bear. Perhaps. What is this?" Valen held up his hand, staring at the twitching fingers. "This is not cold, this is more." He had a sudden, almost irresistible impulse to tell Canis everything, unburden himself, seek solace in confidence. Canis was his friend, after all. His best friend. Who better to tell? With assassins hunting him, he would need a friend to watch his back. They would fight them together. "Confide in no one. This is a secret that could mean your death." Solace's words stilled his tongue, firming his resolve. Canis was his friend, it was true. But he couldn't tell him the truth. It was too big, too important for a whispered secret between boys. He found his shivers receding as his resolve grew. It really wasn't that cold. The fear and horror of his night in the forest had left a mark on him, a mark that might never fade, but he would face it and overcome it. There was no other choice. He retrieved his blanket from the floor and climbed back into his bunk. "Truly, the Earlish is a dangerous place," he said. "You better get those clothes off, brother. Master Solace will whip you raw if you're too chilled to train tomorrow." Canis sat in unmoving silence, a thin sigh escaping his lips in a slow hiss. After a second he rose to undress, laying out his garments with his habitual neatness, carefully stowing his weapons before slipping into bed. Velen lay back and prayed for sleep to take him. Dreams and all. He longed for this night to be over, to feel the warmth of the dawn's light, searing away all the blood and fear that crowded his soul. "Is this a warrior's lot?" he wondered. "A life lived shivering in the shadows?" Canis's voice was barely a whisper, but Valen heard him clearly. "I'm glad you're alive, brother. I'm glad you made it through the forest." Comradeship, he realized. Also a warrior's lot. You share your life with those who would die for you. It didn't make the fear and the sick, hard feeling in his guts disappear, but it did take the edge off his sorrow,
I'm glad you made it too, Canis, he whispered back. Sorry I couldn't help with your mystery. You should talk to Master Solis. He never knew if it was a laugh or a sigh that came from Canis then. Many years later he would think how much pain he would have saved himself and so many others if only he'd heard it clearly. If he had known one way or the other. At the time he took it for a sigh, and the words that followed a simple statement of obvious fact. Oh, I think there'll be mysteries aplenty in our future. They built a pyre on the practice ground, cutting logs from the forest and piling them up under Master Solis's direction. They had been excused training for the day, but the work was hard enough. Valin found his muscles aching after hours of heaving freshly cut timber onto the wagon for transport back to the house, but resisted the temptation to voice a complaint. Mikkel deserved a day's work at least. Master Huttrell returned early in the afternoon, leading a pony laden with a tightly bound burden. As he passed by on his way to the gate, they paused in their labor, staring at the cloth-wrapped body. This will happen again, Valin realized. Mikkel is just the first. Who'll be next?
Dentos?
Canis? Me?
We should have asked him,
Norta said,
after Master Huttrell disappeared through the gate.
Asked him what?
Said Dentos.
If it was a wolf or a bear.
He ducked, narrowly avoiding the log Barkus threw at him. The masters laid the body on the pyre as the boys paraded onto the practice ground in the early evening. Over 400 in all, standing silently in their companies.
After Solis and Huttrell stepped down, the aspect came forward, a flaming torch held aloft in his bony, scarred hand.
He stood next to the pyre and scanned the assembled students. His face was as lacking in expression as ever.
"We come to witness the end of the vessel that carried our fallen brother through his life," he said, again displaying the uncanny ability to project his somnolent tones for the whole crowd to hear. "We come to give thanks for his deeds of kindness and courage, and forgiveness for his moments of weakness. He was our brother and fell in service to the Order, an honor that comes to us all in the end. He is with the departed now. His spirit will join with them to guide us in our service to the faith. Think of him now. Offer your own thanks and forgiveness. Remember him, now and always."
He lowered the torch to the pyre, touching the flames to the applewood kindling they had worked into the gaps between the logs. Soon the fire began to build, flames and smoke rising, the sweet apple scent lost amidst the stench of burning flesh. Watching the flames, Valin tried to remember Mikhail's deeds of kindness and courage, hoping for a memory of nobility or compassion he could carry through his life, but instead found himself stuck on the time Mikkel had conspired with Barkus to put pepper into one of the feed bags in the stable. Master Rensiel had fitted it over the muzzle of a newly acquired stallion and narrowly escaped being kicked to death amidst a shower of horse snot. Was that courage? Certainly the punishment had been severe, although both Mikkel and Barkus swore the beatings were worth it, and Master Rensiel's confused mind had soon let the incident slip into the cloudy morass of his memory. He watched the flames rise and consume the mutilated flesh and bone that had once been his friend, and thought, "I'm sorry, Mikkel. I'm sorry you died because of me. I'm sorry I wasn't there to save you. If I can, one day I will find who sent those men into the forest, and they will pay for your life. My thanks go with you." He looked around to see that most of the other boys had drifted away, gone to the evening meal. But his group was still there, even Norta, although he looked more bored than sorrowful. Jenis was crying softly, hugging himself, tears streaming down his face. Kenis laid a hand on Valin's shoulder. "We should eat. Our brother is gone." Valin nodded. "I was thinking about the time in the stables, remember? The feedback." Kenis grinned a little. "I remember. I was jealous I hadn't thought of it." They walked back to the dining hall, Jenis being dragged along by Barkus, still crying. the others exchanging memories about Mikkel as the fire burned on behind them, taking his body away. In the morning, they found that the remnants had been cleared, leaving only a circle of black ash to scar the grass. In the months and years that followed, even that would fade. Chapter 3. The days came and went. They trained, they fought, they learned. Summer became autumn, and then winter descended with driving rain and biting winds that soon gave way to the blizzards common to Asrael in the month of Olanasa. After the pyre, Mikkel's name was rarely mentioned. They never forgot him, but they didn't talk about him. He was gone. Watching a new batch of recruits march through the gates in early winter, they had the odd sensation of no longer being the youngest. Suddenly the worst chores would be someone else's burden. Looking at the newcomers, Valen wondered if he had ever looked so young and alone. He wasn't a child anymore. He knew this. None of them were. They were different. Changed. They were not like other boys. And his difference ran deeper than the others. He was a killer. Ever since the forest, his sleep had been troubled and he was often left sweating and shivering in the dark by dreams in which Mikkel's slack, lifeless face came to ask why he hadn't saved him. Sometimes it was the wolf that came, silent, staring, licking blood from its muzzle, its eyes holding a question Valen couldn't fathom. Even the faces of the assassins, bloodied and torn, would come to spit hate-filled accusations that would rend him from sleep, shouting unrepentant defiance. "Murderers! Scum! I hope you rot!" Valen? It was usually Canis he woke. Some of the others too, but usually Canis. Valen would lie, say it was a dream of his mother fighting the guilt of using her memory to hide the truth. They would talk for a while until Valen felt the tug of fatigue pulling him to sleep. Canis proved a mine of many stories. He knew all the tales of the faithful by heart, and many others besides, especially the tale of the king. "King Janus is a great man," he said continually. "He built our kingdom with the sword and the faith." He never tired of hearing how Valen had once met King Janus, how the tall red-haired man had laid a hand on his head to ruffle his hair and say, "I hope you have your father's arm, boy," with a deep chuckle. In fact, Valen barely remembered the king. He had only 8 years when his father nudged him forward at the palace reception. But he did recall the opulence of the palace and the rich clothing of the assembled nobles. King Janus had a son and a daughter, a serious-looking boy of about 17, and a girl of Valen's own age who scowled at him from behind her father's long, ermine-rimmed cloak. The king had no queen by then. She had died the previous summer. They said his heart was broken and he would never take another bride. Valen recalled that the girl, his mother called her a princess, had lingered when the king moved on to greet another guest. She looked him up and down coldly. "I'm not marrying you," she sneered. "You're dirty." With that, she scampered after her father without looking back. Valen's father had voiced one of his rare laughs, saying, "Don't worry, boy. I'd not curse you with her." "What did he look like?" Canis asked eagerly. "Was he 6 feet tall, like they say?" Valen shrugged. "He was tall, couldn't say how tall, and he had funny red marks on his neck, like he'd been burnt. When he was 7, he was struck down by the Red Hand," Canis told him, dropping his storyteller voice. "For 10 days he suffered the agonies and blood sweats that would have killed a grown man before his fever broke and he grew strong again. Even the Red Hand, which had brought death to every family in the land, couldn't take Janus. Though but a child, his spirit was too strong to break." Valen surmised that Canis would know many stories.